Welcome to the Scariest Things Podcast, your gateway to the trends and tropes of the horror genre. Podcast special edition. I'm your host, Eric Lee, and as usual, I am joined by
Mike Campbell.
And today we have a very special guest. We have director Travis Stevens, whose film Jacob's Wife just had its world premiere at South by Southwest Film Festival, which the Scariest Things had the honor of actually participating in this year. And it, for those of you who have been under a rock for oh so many years, this is the big festival. This is perhaps the most significant festival in the United States. And, you know, they run a Midnighters program. And Jacob's Wife was one of the headliners in the Midnighters set. So for those of you who are not familiar with Mr. Stevens, he is a longtime horror producer, and this is his second film. The first film, his first big feature was Girl on the Third Floor, which was, I believe, Travis, was the world premiere at Overlook in 2019? I remember showing there.
Actually, it was South By as well, but okay. Yeah, we were fortunate enough to head to New Orleans for Overlook as well.
Mm-hmm. But his production credits... you'll be familiar with some of this stuff. We've got Starry Eyes. We have a couple of the best documentaries you'd ever seen. Jodorowsky's Dune, mm-hmm. which is a mind bender. He was also involved with a little special one for me, 24 by 36, a movie about movie posters.
Yep.
Which I love. He was involved with XX. We've got. Probably looks to be how many production credits? 27 production credits. So, but now making
Good
his
Lord.
Way in as a horror feature director, and this film stars a couple of icons in the industry. We have Barbara Crampton, one of our favorites,
mm-hmm.
And Larry Fessenden, another one of our favorites.
Right.
Looking better than ever, and that's saying something for Larry. You know, we've got in the cast Bonnie Ahrens, the nun, and we have
Volek.
I think one of the fun ones was Robert Russler playing Tom Lowe, who is someone from way back when, from A Nightmare on Elm Street 2. So someone with a number of actors with deep, deep roots in the horror genre. But what we've got here, this is a Jacob's Wife is a dysfunctional family couple who couple on the ropes. We have Anne and Jacob. Anne is beginning to have some wandering eyes after oh so many years, and Jacob is a local minister. And there will be vampires, there will be geysers of blood, and I think before I get too far into it or anything spoilerish, I'll let Travis decide how spoilery he wants to get. You can go full spoiler here if you want, Travis, or you can keep it tight to the vest. But we'd love to have you do the description that I could only do just a surface level of.
So you want to hand me the knife, and if I want to ruin it for the
right,
listeners.
Right.
That's very generous. Thank you so much, Eric. I think you nailed the general, you know, synopsis. It's a movie about Anne Fetter and her husband, Jacob Fetter, and they've been married for 30 years, and she has recently started to feel a bit constricted in her life and in the relationship, and isn't sure what she's going to do about it until this mysterious stranger comes in and sort of fairy godmothers a little change in her life that you know basically reignites her lust for life and her thirst for blood.
Well said. So, you know, I think I'll let Mike. Mike's got the his favorite lead-in question whenever we have a special guest.
Well, I'm curious, Travis, and based on your description there, I'm curious about whether or not this was a film or a film idea, given your exhaustive production credit resume, if this was something that had been kicking around for a while. But most importantly, we always throw the sort of the hardball question first, which is, what is your favorite horror film? And what's your favorite horror genre? And did any of that happen to, or just coincidentally influence this specific film? So that was actually three questions, I guess. That wasn't one question. That was three.
Go ahead and mash it together.
Yeah. I mean, you know, favorite horror film, I think it kind of rotates depending on the day and the mood.
Right.
You know, top five, The Shining.
Yep.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. The Exorcist. The Fly.
Can't go wrong, you know, with any of those.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, like most horror fans, I'm consuming a lot of new and old, good and bad, and everything in between horror films.
Right.
But I think those four, and there's, you know, obviously others as well. But no matter no matter how many times I watch them, I think each time I get something different from them.
Right.
Cronenberg, yes, I'd have to throw in there as well. You know, whether it's video drums or
you threw The Fly
scanners.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, there's that's what's fascinating about timeless horror is, as you sort of go through changes in your life, you pick up on different aspects of the movie that maybe you missed. So maybe you're watching it, you know, when you're younger, and it's just about the visceral thrills and the sort of how scary it is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, get a bit older and you start noticing, oh man, this is really a movie about, you know, a relationship. Yeah. I guess Rosemary's Baby, I'd throw in that top five as well.
Sure. It's a hot list.
And yeah.
So, you know, I think that actually that's a great sort of segue to a question that I had, because when you're talking about aging and changing perspectives and changes, I think one the biggest theme that I saw cutting through this is really, it's a coming of age movie, but instead of a teenage transition, this is midlife crisis transition, right? That Anne is faced looking at the mirror with half of her life behind her, half of the life in front of her. And, you know, I think oftentimes we see horror movies where adolescents, you know, whether it's, you know, I think famously in werewolf movies and sometimes in vampire movies, where it's sort of the allure of the dangerous and the new, and you're starting out your life. But this is menopause horror almost. You know, I think or it certainly felt that way to me. And you know, I thought that I also saw elements of your film where it starts out sort of grim and somber, and then as it picks up, the tone gets lighter as all of a sudden things change with Anne and the opportunities for what she may have wished for as a young woman,
right,
might come to fruition now. But there's a lot of question marks about what's going to happen with Anne, but was I picking up on something intentional there?
Yeah. I mean, both in the story of Anne Fetter, and in the story of Barbara Crampton's, finding this material and wanting to take a more active role in her career by producing movies. Mm-hmm. This is the story of a woman who's looking back on her life for the past 30 years and realizing I need to make some changes to get where I want to go in the second half of my life. And so that's the story. That's the theme. That's the entire reason to make the movie. And that's everything in the movie is in service of that, including what I think you actually pick up on, which is the movie changes as the Anne character changes, and it goes from very restricted, drab, small, confining, feeling movie and world to something big and vibrant and exaggerated and over the top.
Yeah,
just like the movies that Barbara used to make in the '80s.
It really opens
up. So that was So it's on a basic level, it's, you know, I wanted to show audiences some acting from Barbara that maybe they hadn't seen in other roles before. So we wanted to give her dramatic space. We wanted to give her a very sort of naturalistic, grounded performance, as well as honor what she is known for. And so having the movie transform from one to the other was the idea, you know, and it sort of mirrors what happens, or it does mirror what happens with Anne. So you're right. You nailed it. You got it.
Ding, 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 ding. Hey, Travis, where was the film shot? Cause it really felt to me like it, I mean, had this, I love films like that where it has a very real quality to it. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest. I'm from Ohio originally. And, you know, to see the landscape like that was really interesting to me.
South, isn't it?
Where was it?
Yeah. I mean, we shot in Canton, Mississippi, which is really, what's funny about it is the sort of town center has been built up by Hollywood productions that have come in because it has that perfect sort of, Gremlins, Amblin, small town America look.
Right.
But part of that is because productions like Coen Brothers, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or Joel Schumacher's, what is it, A Time to Kill, or whatever.
Yeah, Time to Kill, Mississippi Lawyer. Burning, I think, was shot there.
So there's, some of it is artifice.
Yeah.
In terms of productions came in, put up some facades, but it just evokes that classic Salem's Lot, small town America vibe. And, you know, I'm from a small town in Vermont. My dad's from a small town in South Dakota. When you spend time in spaces like that, there's something about them that is both charming but also haunting.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's a lot of ambience in the quiet spaces in between buildings and in the fields in front of old mills that are closed down. That, you know, when you're in those spaces, it feels great. So, it was nice to try to put that on screen. And that was the idea, is let's take small town America and make it Gothic looking.
Yeah. I think that you hit the melancholy on the head. I think when you know, you have one of the main sets in the movie is a rundown mill.
Right.
Right. And I think there was, I forget who the character was who mentioned that these awful things that are happening are inflicted upon a town because it is a town on decline, and that there is a sense of defeat in the community that allows these intruders to come in, and I think that it gets, so you do, but you still also have, on the other side, you have the flip side of that, you have the sort of the nuclear family small town kind of vibe, sort of butting heads there. But it is, I mean, but it speaks to, I mean, you could have put this in you know, something like, you know, Erie, Ohio, or Gary,
Indiana. Oh yeah,
Indiana,
for sure,
or something
for sure.
Like that, or a town that's seen its better days. And you can tell, actually, I think one of the other elements that sort of was a that signaled that was when Jacob is talking to his flock.
Right.
He's got barely like 30 parishioners.
right.
And I don't know if that was just how many volunteers he got to have show up on the day, but I think the impact was felt like I appreciated the fact that you had, this was not your stereotypical horror movie preacher. This was not your fire and brimstone, here comes the devil preacher. This was a good man trying to do right, but facing stiff odds of people who have stopped caring to some degree, or it felt that way. I don't know. Again, whether I'm interpreting too much.
That's my that's my read as well, and I would say, to a certain extent, even Jacob has stopped caring. The words have lost their power, and, you know, it's sort of, you know, the there's a parallel between what's happened in their relationship and what's happened in this town, which is just the spark is kind of gone. And you can sort of half-heartedly do things like, oh, we're going to renovate the mill and turn it into a, you know, a retail shopping space with, a beer garden, which comes in, but, you know, it's not quite the same.
Or you can invite a nest of vampires in.
So I don't know. I mean, it's something that is true to life, and it's something that you see in the personality of a place sort of slowly getting bleached out. Mm-hmm. It's sad to see, especially if you do spend time in places like this. And it's an interesting backdrop to work against.
Yeah, well, again, great connective work between sort of a town in midlife crisis and a couple in midlife crisis. I think they were all these layers. For those of you who
the town might have been in a long-term care facility.
Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, the houses were still cute and quaint and
Kind of stuff. Yeah, for sure.
But there's sort of a level of sadness to it. Although I did like there was the spunky little kid that you tossed in for some comedic effect later in the film was showed that there are still some whimsical elements still in the town.
Travis, I'm really curious because I loved the kind of the varied score that you had in Jacob's Wife. There was like some synth stuff that sounded like kind of had an 80s sort of throwback quality, and then there were some other bits and pieces that were really interesting. But then going to your first film, A Girl on the Third Floor, I was, you know, it was metal. A super interesting, you know, hardcore and sort of doom soundtrack with Neurosis and Converge and Big Black and Bastard Priest, which is not, obviously, as you know, your typical sort of horror score. And I was really curious how you go about the process as both either a producer or a director in terms of choosing that stuff. I mean, obviously getting Bastard Priest rights to a song is far more easy than maybe, say, I don't know, Led Zeppelin. Yeah. But how do you go about that? And do you have stuff in your head ahead of time before you jump into the film?
Sometimes while writing specifically, yes. I'll write a needle drop or score idea into the screenplay. And even if it gets changed later on, at least it's like a post-it note to myself of what the vibe's supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think and I don't know how effective this is an approach, but my approach tends to be wanting the score to represent what's in the protagonist's experience.
Oh, okay.
A bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the needle drops in Girl on the Third Floor are sort of from the perspective of that character who is thinking of himself as an ass kicking, get it done, right, American badass male.
Yeah. That comes
ridiculous because
it kind of does. It does him in the end, actually.
None of those things. He doesn't, you know, he just bought his drill. He didn't even charge the battery. And yet Converge is like, kick it out. And the drill's like, you don't know what you're doing. So, a similar sort of thought process that led to the Jacob's Wife score, which at the script writing stage, I knew it was very important for the film to have a feminine voice in order to amplify that as strong as possible. I wanted to work with as many female collaborators on it. And, you know, we're a modestly budgeted film. So I reached out to a musician, Tara Bush, whose regular music has such a cinematic quality to it. And although she had never scored a film before, it seemed like she was certainly capable of doing it.
Right.
And so we started talking and she said, yeah, I would love to. And this is something I wanted to do and nobody's ever asked before. And I was like, great. So on this one from the screenwriting stage through pre-production and through production itself, she was actually sending little samples of a musical. We had a much longer schedule on this to work together and really dial it in. And Tara is also a vocalist, so she was able to bring in a literal female vocal element into the score. So it's really trying to put the audience in Anne's head with the music. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple of needle drops in there from other female artists to do the same thing for the supporting characters. Basically.
More layers.
Yeah, well, tell Tara the next time you talk to her, A plus. She killed it. No pun intended.
That's great. I mean, and it's so, maybe it's obvious, but like when you're starting out at something and doing something you've never done before, it's really nice to hear that. You know, I'm going to really appreciate that. You know, it's rad. Like, you know, you're trying, you want to do cool stuff, and it's nice to hear that, hey, I actually, you know, it made an impression.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I think the strongest elements of the film for me was the acting of Barbara and Larry.
Oh yeah.
And what kind of charisma they brought, and certainly, you know, I think you point to that this was Barbara's story, a metaphor, and so she was, I think, gave the performance of her career, and that's saying something. She has a storied career. But what was it like for you? Because both, you know, Larry, of course, is he's sort of the second coming of Roger Corman in some ways as a benefactor to independent filmmakers and as a director himself and an actor who will do almost any role that comes out there.
Eric's saying that as a compliment, by the way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's the best thing because Larry he's a fixture, and the great thing is he won't turn. He will participate in emerging filmmakers' yep. movies as a way to support the film,
right?
And you know, but also working, you know, having, you know, working with a couple of strong personalities and established professionals. What is it like trying to direct people with that kind of a background, or how collaborative was it? Was the process with working with those people?
The process was super collaborative, and what's really nice is we had worked together on We're Still Here back in 2015. So, you know, we were friends, and there was already a comfort level there. But as a filmmaker, as a director, to work with those two people, both Larry and Barbara, is to have 20-foot-tall ass-kicking robots in your corner who are there ready to do whatever needs to be done. Like the amount of emotional sort of cheerleading you get from them is just amazing. I mean, it's you literally feel taller working with them because they're so kind and so generous and so supportive. And so, you know, in terms of collaboration, when I was working on the script, we were having a lot of conversations about what their own long-term marriages had looked like and mm-hmm. what, you know, when they fight, what a fight looks like, how you make up, what, who does what in the relationship in terms of, you know, carrying the weight and different things. And we just really wanted the relationship between Anne and Jacob to be grounded and truthful and authentic and have the fantasy element swirl around that in a chaotic manner, but always have that core be truthful.
Yeah. I did like the hinge point that you threw in there too, where that transition where they both come to sort of this realization of the change in their lives and how they handle it. I thought it was fantastic.
Thanks. And I mean, that's kind of the movie. Like the movie's not this simple, you know, a good woman has a bad husband and has to kill him or something. You know, it's much more about how in a relationship you recognize your own needs and your partner recognizes your needs, and how does the relationship transform to accommodate those changing needs. And, you know, in terms of, you know, both Barbara and Larry have such a well-known sort of iconography in the business and in films. It was fun to basically strip that away and do the opposite with them. And in the review, you know, points this out. You know, Larry, normally when he comes on screen, you're like, here comes the tornado.
Right.
And to play against type with him and say, no, this is a man who is repressed or, you know, very tight and controlling, and will transform him over the movie into something a little looser.
Yep.
And then, you know, Barbara has got such a glamorous, you know, ageless quality to start her in a different, more stripped down place and transform her back into that was another, you know, another layer that was a lot of fun to work with that you only get when you're dealing with people who have such a well-known body of work.
Yeah, right.
There are few people in Hollywood who have aged as gracefully as Barbara Crampton.
True.
Won't give her age away, but she don't look it. Not even close. And it doesn't. And it's. And I was commenting earlier, you know, when you were saying Larry is a tornado. He often looks like he's been in a tornado, right? Like his wild hair and his gap tooth smile and his demeanor. And in this one, he was playing against type as the sort of the conservative in manner kind of persona. It was very interesting, and giving him a chance to really to be more than a secondary player in one of these movies. Actually, he gets to play a lead, was wonderful to see. And clearly they're both eating it up and having a great time doing it. I'm sure particularly if you filmed it chronologically where you finish it off in the manner that you did. I do hope that there is some sort of a happy ending, because there is the potential. There's the potential for this change could be wondrous, or the change could be ruinous. I don't know. I don't know if they have long happy.
Are you angling for
lives.
Jacob's wife too?
I'm kind of. We'll see how it does. I would be supportive to know more about these characters down the road.
Yeah, so would we. I mean, there's they made some progress in their relationship, but I don't think all of the problems have been solved by the end of the movie.
No, they were still negotiating at the end.
Right.
Exactly. And I wanted this, you know, the characters, not only do the characters transform, but, you know, there was kind of a hope that it would be transformative roles for Barbara and Larry as well, where audiences and other filmmakers and casting directors would get to see a side to them that they haven't seen before. And that would allow them to work in a wider variety of spaces. So, you know, there was intention there, and it's been really nice to see how much audiences have and critics have enjoyed watching them actually perform.
Yeah,
actually act, watching a movie that gives them space to, actually act sounds dismissive. I don't mean that.
But you gave them some thespian moments for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Hey, yeah, there's space there for their characters to exist on, you know, in different frequencies.
And real story arcs.
Right.
Right. Real character growth and development and change and, you know, and not just their own, but their relationships. As we've been talking about that a whole bunch, but this is for folks who want. It's a drama with horror elements, really. When it comes down to it, so showcasing the two stars. So.
Right, right.
Well, it's funny because we're talking sort of a bit later in the process of interviews that I've given, and at this point, I now realize, like, man, I really do talk a lot about the drama of the movie. Make no mistake, this is a batshit insane fucking horror movie where the bloody scene all the time. It's just at the core, it's like the world's bloodiest Cadbury egg. You know, at the core, you know, something delicious and nutritious.
You geysers know? Of blood, I think, could be literally. You know, you have multiple moments of. You didn't know a heart could pound that hard to get the blood flowing that much.
Although, you know, the scene that really jumped out at me was early on in the film when the young girl is walking home to her house and the rat jumps out at her. I actually jumped out of my chair. I should have seen that coming like a million miles away. I did not see that coming at all.
Rat jump scare.
Yeah. It was exciting having real rats and playing with real rats.
Right.
Do you have a rat wrangler?
I did. Basically, on this size movie, there's no way we could afford a Hollywood rat wrangler. But we did find a local woman, Lexi Payne, who raised rats for pet stores in the area. And I was in touch with her, and she said, "Yeah, I can get you 40 rats by that date." And sure. They would show up and they'd get the rats out and we just start filming. I'm like grateful because you can do that. Like maybe it's not interesting to every audience member, but if you are interested in the process of making films as well as the films themselves, it's really exciting on small movies to find creative solutions that allow you to have something in your movie that normally only money makes happen.
Right.
And that's been a lot of fun with a lot of the movies I've produced and certainly the movies I've made is we really are making movies in limited means. And anytime you can get something that feels just out of reach and you can get it into your movie, it's pretty exciting.
Well, yeah. And Travis, that's a great segue because one of the things I was really curious about, speaking of great body of work, I mean, your body of work is pretty immense. And I know that you've covered almost every last element of filmmaking. You've done writing, you've done directing, you've done producing, and obviously it's come to you in a specific order. I was curious which of those that you hold near and dear to your heart, or do you hold all of them near and dear to your heart? But more importantly, would you have reversed the order of how you got into the business and how you came about, you know, moving from writer to producer to director, or would you keep it all the same?
It's a deep. I only know that it worked for me.
Right.
This path. And I think the trajectory that worked for me that maybe would have value to other people at the beginning of their careers is I started by learning how movies are financed and sold around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that education and information gave me the resources to get into producing films.
Okay.
And then that experience gave me the confidence and the experience to use my own voice in either a writing capacity and then eventually a directing capacity.
Right.
There are different skill sets,
yeah,
but they do inform each other. And I think the most important thing is whatever your circumstances are, finding a path that gets you as much experience as possible before you start trying to do the big job.
Right.
Yeah. You know, right. Like, If Jacob's Wife had been the first movie that I made, you know, 10 years ago, I don't know if it would have gotten made, and I certainly wouldn't have been as savvy a filmmaker because I wouldn't have been as experienced. So the movie would have not worked as well and probably felt a lot smaller.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have known how to budget it and how to, you know, how to write it in such a way that we could achieve the things we were trying to achieve and all that. And I'm not trying to sound like I'm some super genius, but I think it might be useful for other people who are figuring out, hey, what's my path towards making a movie? You know, it is really useful to see how movies are made.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that'll set you up.
It's as if you're going in with your eyes open by the time you hit directing, because a lot of what we see a lot from, particularly in the independent horror film directors is people who have cut their teeth on doing lots of shorts, right?
Right.
Or they're coming from advertising, or some they've been doing directing in a more compact level,
on a micro level, yeah.
Before they catch their big break, but that can be pretty daunting, and it's particularly if you're trying to come up and you're going to try and extend something from a short film story to a large film, like when you see some films that feel like they've been stretched too thin, that they take the plot and they haven't got it all figured out and they pad it.
Right.
It's like, well, they might have been a short filmmaker who just didn't, you know, the diagnosing what it takes to get that full story to the screen. You know, it's a different path, and I think it's a very interesting path. And it sort of sets you up for potentially pretty good success. Because it can't be easy. I think one of the things that's impressive is you're now 2 for 2 on your first 2 feature films landing at South by Southwest, right? And I'm pretty sure that they get hundreds, if not thousands, of submissions to get into the festival. I think, you know, Mike and I were feeling pretty house proud that, that we got in. It's like, hey, you guys are legit press, because, you know, we had to, it's like, it was almost sending in a college entrance exam to get in as part of the press pool. It's like, you got to send in 5 samples of your writing, and you got to write a mission statement and all these other kinds of things. It's like, really? But that's because most other film festivals, yes, please, you know, come on board and help us out. And South by Southwest, it's like, we're pretty selective. So, you know, does it feel, and then probably this dials back to, Girl on the Third Floor, when you found out that you were going to get South by Southwest selected?
Well, I've been really fortunate to have had a lot of movies play there. And each time we submit, it's the same sense of anxiety, hope, you know, because they do such a good job of showcasing such a wide variety of what's happening in specifically in the horror program, but with all of their program, they really are looking around the world for the next new thing, the right. next new voice. So work that is, you know, creating something new and exciting. And so, to have this second film be accepted as well, it feels like a huge victory, because it, you know, at least I take it as like, hey, you're on the right path.
Yeah, it's a validating step.
Yeah, you haven't got old and out of touch. You still know what the kids like. No, but and I think too, maybe there's a maybe because Austin as a town of cinema lovers, you know, with Fantastic Fest and South by Southwest and what the Draft House does down there, they like their movies big and wild. Mm-hmm. And that's my sensibility as well. It's like, if we're going to make a horror movie, let's go for it and celebrate it, horror in the biggest terms, like step on the distortion pedal, hit the guitar chord, and fucking let the room ring. And I think that plays very well to that town. There are other places in the world that perhaps finds it a little less sophisticated than they like,
right?
And I respect that. But you know, it feels good to have work that South by is so supportive of.
So given that you are 2 for 2, are you going big time now? Or are you going to do the Exorcist reboot? Or are you attached to that? Or what is your next project, I guess, is what I'm really trying to say.
Mike is just for context. Mike has been fishing around to who the rumored Exorcist reboot director.
I'm like, that can't be real. that whole thing can't be real.
This is very, very funny, and I would normally not say this at all, but it's just too perfect for this particular moment. I actually am, as a producer, working on an Exorcist movie.
Oh, you're kidding.
but it is not the movie, not the reboot that you're thinking of.
Okay.
It's, I don't want to say more than that, but it is.
Fair enough.
It is
Fair enough.
An Exorcist movie. I'm just a producer. The director has been working on it for a while, and it's very exciting. So probably next year.
Oh, cool.
When it becomes publicly known, you can say, holy shit, we had that scoop.
Scariest things, breaking news.
Yeah, it's not fictional. Sure. I'll say that.
All okay. Right. Oh, cool.
Oh, hey now. Super oh, that cool. Sounds great.
Super cool.
So,
but in terms of, you know, what I'm doing next is we're casting right now another movie that is set in a horror subgenre. It's my take on a very well-known subgenre, and it does the same thing. It tries to turn it on its head a little bit.
Cool. We like that.
Yeah, we're all about horror adjacent. We
yes, we are.
We've done at least two podcasts where we debate horror or not, but we'll watch it anyways. You know, I think there was a big debate. One of the we did our top 100 movie list, and what we do is we survey all of our media contacts and some of our patrons, and we develop a list. And one of the movies, it's like, is Blue Velvet a horror movie?
Right.
And I was like, oh man, no, not really. But two of our people said it was their favorite horror movie of all time. I was like, ah, okay, well, what do we do with this? Well, let's talk it. Horror adjacent. Next to horror, we love it.
Yep.
So.
Well, it's funny that you bring up Blue Velvet, because during the production of Jacob's Wife, I was analyzing some of the sequences in Blue Velvet in sort of building up to reveals, mm-hmm. You know, specifically when he's going to Frank Booth's apartment for the first time, and there are horror sequences in that movie for sure.
Yeah,
so, like as far as the vocabulary.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it certainly was, if nothing else, super super dark and weird. So, you know, that very, you know,
that's an understatement.
Lynchian, yes. As they would say.
Yep.
Travis wanted to say thank you so much.
Big
for,
thank you.
For joining us.
And congratulations on the film. It's awesome. We loved it.
Check out the Scariest Things review that I put up. I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. Hoping that you get a chance to see this soon. When is it going to, is it going to have a theatrical release, or is it going to be it's a Shudder release? Yes.
It'll actually April 16th. So 2 weeks, it'll be out in theaters where it's safe and on VOD in the US.
Okay.
And then it'll be on Shudder later in the year. I don't have the exact date on that. And I don't have the exact list of theaters yet, but in 2 weeks, people will be able to find it where you normally find your kick-ass independent horror films, whether it's iTunes or Amazon or wherever your VOD predilections lie.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be able to have it here at the Hollywood Theater, which is our independent...
it's our meager film version of the Alamo Draft House. Yeah.
It's Alamo Light. So, anyhow...
I think this is a movie best enjoyed with a big goblet of wine. So
at the Hollywood, you can definitely get beer and a pizza.
Can you get wine? Oh yeah, for sure.
Do that.
For sure.
Check out, you know, for our Portland, we are a Portland, Oregon based podcast with Liz, who couldn't make it in New Orleans, but we're always trying to get our listeners and fans to go out, and once things open up, please go to your theaters, support your local cinemas, because I think I just got my first shot, my vaccination shot today, so I'm feeling half healthy, ready to take on the movie theaters, and hoping that you guys get a chance to catch Jacob's Wife.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's a great film. Thanks again, Travis.
Oh, of course. I just want to shout out one last. Our visual effects team is Portland adjacent, Beaverton.
Oh, hey, all right.
Hey, very cool.
So, do you mind saying what's the production company or the
the VFX team, Eli Dorsey and Ray Kelly. So, you know, this is not funny or anything. So, I mean, it's weird to segue to it, but during their work was when the fires were happening there, and Ray Kelly actually was helping evacuate neighbors and stuff when the fires were going down up during post. So it was, I felt a stronger connection to Oregon during that than normal, you know?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, that was,
it was actually, you know, whatever, 2 degrees of separation. It was terrible.
So those were horrible, surreal days. So yep. Good on you, VXF team, for doing Oregon proud. Keep the blood flowing. Are they going to be a part of your next effort also?
They've been on many movies, so yeah, why not? They're in the band. They're in the band for life. They're like fucking, I don't know, Keith Richards. Can't kick them out.
Permanently entrenched.
Yes.
Can't dig them out. Okay. Well, with that, thank you once again, and we will catch you back on our normal podcasting, but this was a treat.
Indeed. Indeed. Thanks, Travis.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yep.